Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and some human-made audio. And this week, the long history of North of England renaissances, a difficult-to-pin-down smell that lives in an apartment in Brooklyn, and Ella de Guzman, the bag detective. But first, a long unfulfilled promise: the North will rise again. Despite various Westminster initiatives from devolution referenda to levelling up agendas, the identity and the mythos of the North of England are dominated by a sense of decline and even failure. But in his new book, The North Will Rise Again, writer and academic Alex Niven suggests some other ways to think about the place he calls home, ways that acknowledge the regular explosions of culture from the modernist poetry scene of Newcastle in the 1960s to the Republican balladry of the Stone Roses, little fires which offer a less weary vision of the territory and its people. He talked to Culture File about the distinguishing features of a part of England called the North.
The North does have a coherent, unified sense of self. It's defined by the Industrial Revolution and its aftermath. It's defined by a sense of difference from the centralised establishment culture of England, kind of centering on London and the South East. Often the first question people ask is, you know, where does the North start? I'm not quite sure is the answer. You know, I'd say by the time you get to sort of Sheffield, Liverpool, Manchester, that's definitely the North. And then obviously up to the Scottish border, it's definitely begun by the time you get to Sheffield, Liverpool, Manchester.
I suppose the slightly more interesting question is, when does the North start? You talk in the book, you're describing these sort of two visions of the North, which are kind of happen at different times. And there's the one which is lost now, which is as a sort of hub of invention and innovation and industrial innovation. And then that one, that other one, which we kind of experience more now of post-industrial decline, is kind of like the North exists in time as much as space.
You can't avoid the fact that, yeah, the North is brought into being really with the advent of the Industrial Revolution. That's the thing that transforms this backwater really in terms of development of various kinds of, you know, infrastructure and culture and the economy and so on. The Industrial Revolution overhauls that and overturns that narrative so that the North of England is really the, you know, the centre of the world and the cradle of the Industrial Revolution and so on and so forth. You know, the book's focused on the last half century, sort of 50, 60, 70 years. And obviously the narrative of that period is deindustrialization, the removal of industry. We haven't yet found a replacement for that culture and for that economic infrastructure and everything that comes along with it. So, the contemporary North, unfortunately, is defined by that absence still.
When it happened, we walked through all the estates from Manchester to Newcastle.
So the title, The North Will Rise Again, it's become a slogan, a piece of graffiti in the North, The North Will Rise Again. It derives ultimately from Marquis Smith and a song from quite early on in the career of his band, The Fall. It's it's obviously derives ultimately from a sort of biblical notion of, you know, rising again from the dead. And
there is some suggestion it also relates to kind of Southern secession.
It does, yeah. I mean,
in the United States.
Yeah. I mean, it can get a bit controversial, can't it? Because obviously, you know, I'm not kind of advocating the Confederacy by any means. But yeah, the South Will Rise Again was a Confederate slogan. I mean, I would hope that it's far enough removed from that context, in the context of the North of England, that it's clear that it's not advocating, you know, slavery or anything like that. And indeed, it's obviously it's in a sense a kind of, I think for Marquis Smith, a sort of détournement or reappropriation, positive reappropriation of that slogan.
I'm Joe Total, the yet unborn son. The North will rise again. The North will rise again. Not in 10,000 years. Not in 10,000 years. Too many people.
There have been attempts. And I mean, that's one of the things that you're interested in the book, is these sort of attempts in the latter half of the 20th century to kind of recapture the sort of technopolis of the North.
You know, one way of reading the cultural narrative of the post-war period is really an attempt, as deindustrialization is really kicking into gear and starting to accelerate, as the mines are starting to close down and the North's economic infrastructure is collapsing, really, you have various attempts to, as you say, you know, kind of revive industrial culture, particularly in aesthetic and cultural ways. So you have various kind of sci-fi narratives, for example, from Anthony Burgess's Clockwork Orange to Ridley Scott's Blade Runner, you know, taking deindustrializing North as inspiration for these incredibly sort of futuristic and kind of visionary sci-fi works, not necessarily positive ones. In both cases, they're kind of dystopian visions of the future. You know, Ridley Scott's on record as saying that, in some senses, at least the opening of Blade Runner is inspired by his formative years in industrial Teesside and this kind of, in some senses, bleak landscape, but also a landscape that Scott felt was you know, beautiful in his terms, and that he could create something beautiful and visionary out of that industrialized, perhaps already deindustrializing landscape.
As well as the sort of cultural projects of modernization, there was one figure who reappears again and again in your book, which maybe a lot of people wouldn't be familiar with who don't come from the area, T. Dan Smith.
T. Dan Smith attracts my attention and attracts my interest, you know, for starters, that he's a major figure in the cultural history of the Northeast and still looms large over our political and cultural history, particularly in Newcastle, where I live now. He was a council leader in the post-war years in Newcastle at this time when various parts of provincial Britain, as it were, but particularly northern cities, were being empowered by the sort of social democratic culture of the time to act independently and assertively in reviving and asserting northern culture and instituting or trying to institute various revivals of the North. So T. Dan Smith did this very forcefully, or tried to do this very forcefully in Newcastle, built loads of social housing during his period, as it were. We had, you know, this kind of big modernistic town hall built. We had plans laid down for a kind of metro rail service. So there's a sense that T. Dan is, you know, I talk about him as both a hero and an anti-hero. I think, you know, some of those schemes of the post-war years were quite heroic. I mean, the better known narrative about T. Dan is that he was found guilty of corruption and went to prison for it in the 70s. You know, I don't think there's much doubt that he was guilty of the specific things he was charged of. Nonetheless, they were, you know, relatively minor. And I think there's no doubt that he has become a sort of shorthand for discrediting this left-leaning modernist culture in the North, and a kind of shorthand for why we need to revert to kind of traditionalism and conservatism in the case of architecture and culture more generally. So I wanted to, in some sense, advocate T. Dan's example and, you know, suggest that there's something to be derived from that, and that might provide some sort of inspiration in terms of future revivals of the North. In the very early 60s, his council, as leader of the council, it was the first council in the country to have a kind of in-house architect, a guy called Wilf Burns, who was responsible for the Eldon Square shopping mall, which isn't actually architecturally that good on the whole and on the exterior. Actually, T. Dan Smith tried to get Arne Jacobsen, a much more famous Danish architect, to design kind of 60s shopping mall. That didn't come off. But one thing that did come off was it had this tremendous kind of sci-fi atrium with a cafe shaped like a flying saucer, various trappings of this post-war modernist aesthetic. And I talk in the book, obviously, in the memoir passages about being struck by this as a child and finding Newcastle to be an incredibly exciting place in the 80s and 90s because of the legacy of this post-war modernist period and the buildings that emerged from that, which, you know, sometimes sort of demonized and talked about in terms of concrete monstrosities. But, you know, certainly as a child, you know, walking into Eldon Square and seeing this kind of, you know, flying saucer cafe, I would at least compare it favorably to the sort of architecture that we have today in the city, which is, on the whole, more kind of corporate and prosaic, and architecture and development that arises from the empowerment of big business and the market, as opposed to having slightly more idealistic ideas about human progress.
I love this idea that, you know, what the council did was actually shaping minds like you. What they decided to build was kind of building your worldview at the same time. And I guess that for your cohort, that was probably happened quite generally. It's a relationship to the city architecture that, you know, I think is quite rare today.
There's a sort of literal sense in which T. Dan Smith's legacy shaped who I was, in that, you know, my dad's came to the Northeast as a lecturer at Newcastle Polytechnic, which is part of T. Dan Smith's scheme for the kind of educational expansion of the Northeast. So that is my kind of, I have a very specific kind of family connection to this culture of, you know, an empowered public sector, a kind of pre-rise of the market era, if you like, in terms of how cities are put together and how local infrastructure and local jobs are organized and arranged. That was the culture that I literally emerged from.
I suppose another aspect of what shaped the people of the area was something like you talk about in the Morden Tower scene, you know, a literary culture, which is sort of more what you would expect to be part of the sort of coming of age story of the critic or the artist.
I mean, the Morden Tower scene was all about, you know, a revival of forms of modernist poetry. It was about doing new and radical things with poetry. It arose when a couple of quite young people, figures, Tom and Connie Pickard, rented a section of the town walls, the old medieval walls of Newcastle, from the council, actually, and started putting on quite spontaneous, countercultural, freewheeling poetry readings in the mid-60s. And they became a big epicentre of a sort of modernist revival, which has obvious parallels with this attempt to, you know, revive the modernist traditions of the North in this period of deindustrialisation. You know, there were kind of big differences with the kind of more hard-edged modernist aesthetic of the architecture being produced in the city at that time. Nonetheless, I think there were certain affinities. And I think it all comes back to this question of how to, on the most basic level, revive Northern culture, kick against this quite centralised culture that we have in England, which is predominantly based in the southeast and in London. There's a fierce desire to revive, advocate, regenerate the North.
The North.
The kind of musical counterculture that arose in Manchester during what I call the long 80s, that is, you know, from the very late 70s until the sort of early to mid 90s. I think this is a time of tremendous cultural flowering, largely through music, through pop music, throughout Britain and indeed Ireland. But perhaps in Manchester, it's most vigorous and most wonderful, really. So, you know, we all know the bands, you know, the kind of legendary bands of that period, from sort of Joy Division through the Smiths, arguably, you know, ending with Oasis. But for me, the Stone Roses are quite an important climactic moment in that narrative of this Manchester music scene. In a sense, neo-modernist Manchester music scene of the long 1980s. A song, a very short song on their debut album, Elizabeth My Dear, is in a sense a kind of folk song. It's based on the melody of Scarborough Fair, an old northern ballad discovered in the modern period being sung by a kind of lead miner from the far north Pennines in County Durham, and transferred through various sources, Martin Carthy among others, Simon and Garfunkel, to the Stone Roses, who in 1989 apply a quite insurrectionary set of lyrics to the melody of Scarborough Fair. Elizabeth, My Dear, is a song about getting rid of the monarchy, getting rid of the Queen. My name is true, my message is clear, it's curtains for you, Elizabeth, my dear. You know, for me, the revival of the North has to be radical. I think that's quite an important point in a context where a lot of the kind of revivalism and regeneration schemes of the North and in the North over the last few decades have basically been neutralized by sort of appeals to moderation and, you know, the sense that this is the best we can ever hope for. Leveling out the country, leveling up in the current kind of cliched terminology, has to entail some kind of radical overhaul of England and Britain and how they're structured constitutionally, which at some point will have to factor in some kind of getting rid of the monarchy or at least substantial reform of this, you know, medieval constitution that we have in England. So, you know, Elizabeth, My Dear by the Stone Roses, you know, brings together that sense of a kind of cultural revival or blossoming or renaissance that we had in Manchester in the 80s with this underlying sense that, you know, if you want to truly revive or regenerate the North, you're going to have to tear things up at the roots. You really have to overhaul the constitution. You have to, in the end, go for a radical solution, a radical overhaul of the way the country's structured.
I'll not rest till she's lost her throne. My aim is true, my message is clear. It's curtains for you, Elizabeth, my dear.
Few changes since then. I was talking to Alex Niven, whose book, The North Will Rise Again, is out now. And next we have the second instalment of our new series of stories about scent and memory from the writer Orit Gat. In this piece, she's exploring how sometimes the words become harder to find when times, places and scents merge.
The most romantic line I've ever read in a book was, "I will not describe it except to say that I could." The author, Catherine Schultz, is writing about her first kiss with her partner in her book Lost and Found. I think about that line so often, or how to describe something when it feels like you're the only one on earth who knows it. So many scents are described using the same adjectives. Things are acrid, floral, musky, musty, sweet, faint. And yet, none of those words feels even close to how the hallway of the building I lived on 35 Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn, smelled. And yet, there isn't a word for, "I would know it the second I feel it." And yet, there isn't a word for, "I can't describe it, but if I ever encounter it again, I would be flooded by it." When I lived on 35 Eastern Parkway, it was in one of those periods in life when everything feels like a mess, so you roll with it. I must have had the lease on that flat for years, but barely ever lived there. I had a lot of visa issues at the time. I traveled a lot, avoiding dealing with immigration services. 35 Eastern Parkway was a building with over 100 flats, and I mostly sublet mine. I can barely count the number of people who had stayed there. Friends and strangers, people passing through New York, someone going through a breakup, and someone else who had just moved to the city and stayed there while looking for her own place. So many people lived there who weren't on the lease. My landlord never knew. You'd think that flat wouldn't mean much to me. I say, I barely lived there. I say, I basically shared it. But I hold on. I came and went. Still, I always remember that specific moment, after a trip or even just a night out, when I'd come out of the lift on the fifth floor and I would be surrounded by it. A scent. Again, I will not describe it except to say that I would like to. That flat was my happiest and unhappiest place, where I lived when I decided to leave New York, where I lived when life was in flux, disregarding the need for an actual home. The smell I'm thinking of wasn't the smell of my flat. It was the shared space. The welcome back, the welcome in, the "it's still there." It, the scent of coming and going. It felt specific, but there is no specific way to say this. And who can you say it to? They say no one wants to hear about your dreams. What feels rich in symbolism or mystery or narrative to you may not be to others. Try then to describe something elusive like the scent of a hallway, and explain how it came to mean so much to you. I wonder, was it special? Did anyone else at 35 Eastern Parkway love it like I did? When my downstairs neighbor came up once to complain about the sound of the Smiths playing when I was washing the dishes after a dinner party, why didn't I ask, while apologizing for still listening to Morrissey, what the fourth floor smelled like? It's one of those weird things about living in a large building. You have no reason to go anywhere but the hallway and your own floor, right? There's this whole unknown space that is still officially your address. You don't know what it smells like. Maybe it's the same. It's not just my old building, right? Most homes have a smell. But in a shared building, it feels different. Whose scent is that, even? The amalgamation of all these lives. And, for me, that sense of being present and being gone and constantly noticing it. It's the presence that comes through in scent. Once you've been somewhere several times, you know this sense of presence. I had a neighbor whose place smelled like the Muji diffuser that she used, gorgeous and store-bought. I had an ex-boyfriend whose flatmate always complained his room smelled musty. I thought it smelled like him, like his clothes, and I loved everything about it. There's a dusty smell to a house I go to once a week, always mixed with the faint, almost natural, still a bit metallic scent of supermarket-bought flowers. A friend whose cat I feed, whose flat always smells like her perfume, very expensive. I feel like it would be almost impolite, too intimate, to point out that you know the smell of someone's home. To know something so domestic about someone feels like it would be almost too close to them. Perhaps that's why I tell about it. Because to know someone else is all I ever want. That ex-boyfriend. Sometimes, when I would put my head on his shoulder on the bus, I would be flooded by the scent of his clothes, also somehow the scent of his home. We stayed friends after we broke up, and that was all I could think of every time we hugged politely when one of us walked into the bar as the other was waiting. How I would be flooded by that musty scent. That scent his roommate complained about. That scent I loved so much because I loved him and because I loved knowing something about him. When I say musty, I think it may sound negative, but what I mean is more like familiar, something you're astonished to know, and, oh, I guess I'm here again. I didn't realize I would be.
Orit Gat there with the second installment of her Scent Stories, which she will continue in a fortnight's time. And finally this time, is that a real one? Ella de Guzman is a Vancouver native who moved to Dublin and set up Shupa Ella, a place that specialises in reselling designer goods, authentic designer goods, especially handbags. De Guzman is an authenticator of handbags with the gift of telling a fake Stella McCartney Falabella from a real one. Ella shared some of her wisdom at the Talk Cabaret Club D8 Live in Rialto this week, ahead of which she shared some with Culturefile in the Dior and Vuitton-filled basement of her Wicklow Street HQ.
My name is Ella de Guzman. I'm originally from Vancouver, BC, Canada. That's Belle that you just heard. There's Louis, my dog that I moved over here with back in 2010 on Paddy's Day of all days.
When does this historically begin as a thing? I mean, people have bought handbags for a long time. When did they begin to think of them as kind of permanent commodities or tradable in some way?
I think I would argue that the concept came from North America. When I was growing up in the 90s, this is how me and my friends would make money. This is how me and my friends would shop. We would buy a top for $25, but we know it would only cost us really $10 because we'd plan on reselling it after. That was just the way we always shopped back in Canada. But Canada is a very eco-friendly, environmentally friendly country to begin with. Like, you know, you'd get money back for bottles and cans, and that's norm. It's norm to get money back for goods. And I think when I moved over here, I was actually shocked that there was no one really doing it. Here's a Stella McCartney Falabella bag. Now, if you knew what these are supposed to look like, the chain of this Falabella is way too fine. A Falabella tote bag, it's a Stella McCartney hobo style bag with the chain that goes all the way around. And when she had sent me photographs of this, I thought, oh, maybe it's just kind of dirty. That's why it looks like that. But then, see, I have to feel things. So as soon as it came in the post, she shipped it to me. And I'm like, this is not what it's supposed to feel like at all. And then obviously on closer inspection, the weight of the lacing that goes around the bag is incorrect. Stella McCartney would have her logo engraved here, and it's missing. The engraving here is pretty good, but see how that's bubbled there on the logo? Like, that would never have passed quality control. When you open up the bag, I mean, the dead giveaway, really, is this. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, I can't believe.
What is it?
It says Stella, the A is even missing. Stella McCartney, and the Y is cut off. So, I mean, that's a really, really bad fake. So easy to tell when I see it. But sometimes customers will just send me a picture like this and then I can't tell. So I say, okay, you need to send it in.
So have you broken it to that person that this isn't real?
She's mortified. Yeah. And she has to come. And we do say to customers, like, if you're in my office right now, I have about 8 bins of fake bags. We were asked before to partner with a pretty large company. And they were shocked that I still oversaw the authentication. And they're rightly so, right? Because they said, how is it possible that one person does it all? I said, well, I've been doing this for 12 years now. I've been doing it all. You know, there are a lot of companies now, they use AI. So they use a program called Entropy. And basically it scans, like, you get your little device, you scan a bag, it tells you if it's real or fake, like drop of a hat or like that. It's pretty instant. I refuse to use Entropy. because I want to oversee it myself. It's part of, it's just, I think if I ever got to a stage in life where I didn't want to be that involved in the business, but actually, I actually enjoy authenticating. It's detective work.
Why are handbags fascinating?
You know what? It's a good question, because at the end of the day, you can carry around everything in a plastic bag. Really, that's all it is, isn't it? But we live in a society where we will go into debt to impress people we don't even like. And that's just human nature, isn't it? Because at the end of the day, we don't have to be wearing anything. Like, you could, I have the same clothes that I've had for 20 years now. You know, I'm one of those people who really, I don't really throw things away. We do really need to be more mindful about how we use our own items and just don't put things on the ground. When they ask me what the worst investment is, definitely shoes, footwear. We've sold pairs of shoes for €1,000. But the minute you walk out this door in a pair of €1,000 shoes, what are you stepping on? Not carpet, right? So they get destroyed so quickly. So I always say to, you know, shoes would probably be the number one worst investment, no matter what designer they're, if they're Hermes or Chanel, or worst investment.
Well, I guess that's why all the sneakerheads keep them in the box.
They don't use them, right? It's really for display.
And does that happen with bags?
A lot of people, yeah, will just have, they'll have, there's, I have a few collectors, you know, I would class myself as a collector. Like, I just look at it and it makes me happy. That's my little collection. I'll go out in Dublin and I'll see a customer leaving like a €2,000 bag on the floor. I'm like, what are you doing? Why are you putting that €2,000 bag? Like, you know, you could ask a cut the rent and I'll ask for an extra share for my Chanel bag.
Okay, so you've got there one of your favorites. Now, it's a Louis Vuitton.
This is a Louis Vuitton. It's a vintage Louis Vuitton Noe bag. So this was manufactured, I think this style came out in the 1960s. And the idea of it was to hold 5 bottles of champagne. So you'd have 4 champagne bottles upright and then 1 upside down. Hence, one of my favorite bags.
That is so, a very good marketing story.
Isn't it though, right? So, but I've always loved this style. Like, I have one, I have 2 of them myself. They come in different sizes and it's got a great drawstring closure, but these tend to break over time. This, I think this is from the 1990s. Actually, it is quite old, this one. So I love how the leather is patinaed quite nicely. And then you have here, so obviously when you're authenticating this bag, you can look at the font here. It's quite nice and fine. Okay.
A very, very small Louis Vuitton embossed near the bottom.
Exactly.
Of the bag.
And then here, I don't know if you can see, but there is writing along here.
I can't quite see it, actually.
It's like a little stamping of the date code.
Yeah.
But yeah, this would probably be one of my favorite designs because I think it's quite practical. It's easy. You could take the straps off here. But I just love the story behind it, that it was originally designed to hold 5 bottles of champagne.
Works for whiskey and wine as well.
Exactly, right?
Is there anything about the work on it, about the craft on it that you like?
Like, I think the fact that it's really durable. Like, the way the Louis Vuitton bags, a lot of people think that Louis Vuitton is actually, like, the canvas that you see here, the LV print, is actually leather, but it's coated plastic, like, you know, plastic coated canvas. But it's actually so durable. Like, if you think about this bag, it's probably 30 years old and there's still loads of life left in it. Like, there's not a mark to the canvas, right? So they're very, very durable bags. However, I go into the other realm and then we're talking Chanel. This is the opposite of this one. Like, I've been known to put Louis Vuitton Noe bags in the washing machine and they come out fine.
And when that was new, what did it cost?
Oh, like, back in the day, this probably was only a couple €100.
And but now?
Probably rode over 1,300. You know, but we're selling this for quite little. It's only €400 because you'll need to get a new string. Guess how much one of these strings will cost you?
£100.
Yeah, just for a piece of leather. And that cost of that was probably really only 50 cents. But you're paying €100 because of Louis Vuitton. So it has a bit of TLC. But no, I just love the design of that one.
Do you think it has another 20 years in it?
30 years? Oh, yeah. That will, like, outlive us for sure if it's taken care of.
Ella de Guzman there of Shuppa Ella, bringing to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more material call-outs next Saturday tea time. Till then, bye now.